This is Ron Orrell, host of the Activist Investing Today podcast, and I'm super excited today to be speaking with one of the top advisors to activists in the U.S., Andrew Friedman, co-managing partner and chair of the Shareholder Activism Practice at Olshan Frum Wolosky in New York. Today, we're going to be talking about LA-based activist investor Browning West's total victory, and I mean total victory, at Gildan Activewear, a Canadian clothing company. One of the most interesting contests of the year. Just ahead of an annual meeting in May, Gildan's entire board stepped down, paving the way for Browning's entire 8-person slate of directors, which reinstated longtime CEO Glenn Chamandy as CEO, who was removed and ousted, and this ousted a recently installed CEO, Vince Tyra. So we're going to get into all this. Thanks, Andrew, for taking the time.
You got it. Thanks, Ron. Great to be on here with you.
Okay. So this is one of the most interesting contests of the year for a lot of reasons. One of which I thought was interesting was that Gildan filed a lawsuit, which was later dismissed in Montreal, related to U.S. Hart-Scott-Rodino filing requirements involving the activist Browning West, which I thought was interesting. And separately, the clothing company also appeared to sense an impending loss in April as they shook up their entire board, well, a big part of their board, announcing that 5 incumbent directors, including then-chairman Donald Berg, resigned, while 2 others, board members of an M&A committee, wouldn't seek re-election. So we had, you know, an unusual lawsuit involving U.S. Hart-Scott-Rodino filings in Montreal, and you had a situation where a massive amount of the board stepped down just like very shortly before the contest was set to conclude. So, Andrew, you advised Browning West. At the center of this battle, the two sides have been at odds over the company's move in December to oust the CEO, Glenn, a longtime CEO, from his position and install this Vince Tyra, a former executive at Hochens Industries, in his place. Talk about how this dispute emerged and maybe get into a little bit about this very unusual early development where 32% of shares held by a number of investors, you know, not, this is not one investor, this is, I don't know, like a dozen or so investors, came out publicly outraged by Glenn's ouster. I mean, you never really see that so many shares, you know, issuing press releases, talking to reporters, different news organizations, raising concerns about the CEO's removal. Typically, both sides are desperate to find one measly investor to support their side. So should this have been a red flag that so many investors came out publicly upset about his removal?
Yeah, Ron, it should have been a massive red flag for the board and its advisors. You just don't see that level. We use the word unprecedented in terms of describing the reaction, a guttural reaction from such a large swath of the shareholder base. And what was really unprecedented about the reaction to the December 11th announcement, and again, let me just take a step back. That's what jump-started this proxy fight. And I remember it well. It was December 11th, and I was actually at a shareholder activism conference at the time, and my phone starts ringing off the hook. I'm getting emails, and it's my client Browning West reaching out saying that they need to speak immediately, as this news had just broke that one of their significant portfolio companies, Gildan, had taken what was viewed as in an incredibly surprising action in terminating its longtime CEO and co-founder, Glenn Chamandy, and announcing his replacement as Vince Tyra. That's what kicked off this campaign in all respects. And then in the coming days and weeks, to have the outpouring of independent public angst from shareholders who were rightly so concerned about their investment in this company, given that this sort of transformational leader, someone that they viewed as a value creator, was being replaced by someone like Vince Tyra, that they, after doing some of their diligence and their homework, viewed as a value destroyer and someone that doesn't have anything that comes close to the level of expertise in apparel, and especially the specific area of low-cost manufacturing that Gildan finds itself. And so really, that's what jump-started this. And what really blew my mind, and I think blew the minds of many of these shareholders, is the extent to which the board and its advisors, upon seeing this massive outpouring from or whether it's 32%, 35%, whatever the specific number was. But this independent, whether it was a press release or otherwise, but public outcry from such a large portion of its shareholder base, instead of taking a step back, reconsidering its actions, meeting with its shareholders and engaging openly and thoughtfully around this key decision, they went a completely different course and they dug in, doubled down. And it's really what led to, and I use this term a lot in situations that end up being control fights, but it's a perfect storm mm-hmm. of facts and circumstances mm-hmm. has to present itself and exist to create the situation where an investor feels compelled to nominate a full slate or control slate and to seek a reinstatement of a CEO. And here, look, the board had the opportunity with its advisors to sort of rethink its decision. And I think the board was shell-shocked. And I don't think as rocked as the shareholders were on December 11th and hearing the news that this sort of CEO that they had full faith and belief in was being abruptly terminated and replaced with Vince Tyra, as unnerving as that was for the investors, I don't think the board saw it coming, that this level of independent outcry would come in the days and weeks following that decision. And they regrouped as a board with their advisors, and they could have gone a number of different ways. And the situation could have played out in a number of different ways. It didn't have to be a full board sweep, as ended up being the case come 6 months later. And you've seen now the recent news of, and we'll maybe get into this as well, the extreme costs of this campaign. This campaign had costs on many levels, but they pulled out every trick in the book. Every part of the defense playbook was mobilized by the company and the board. They felt, for whatever reason, that the board felt so compelled, so convicted in that it was doing the right thing in forcing the termination and the succession process involving Glenn Chamandy in replacement with Vince Tyra, that they were willing to sort of go to all lengths to protect that decision. Yeah. Rather than work in good faith with the investors who came out in droves.
Yeah. And talking about, you know, so I was looking at some of the different investors that came out. These are, you know, it wasn't most of the big investors that came out weren't, you know, other activist investors or hedge funds. Like Janus Henderson came out publicly. I mean, you know, that's not a fund that is frequent to come out publicly opposed to the removal of the CEO.
Exactly. Yeah,
that should have been a big red flag.
It says a ton. It says more. It wasn't just a group of activist investors or investors who are prone to put out these types of public responses and public statements. They had to go through their internal channels at investment firms, institutions that where this isn't in their DNA. That should have spoken volumes to the board. But for whatever reason, they pressed on. The board doubled down. They went to so many lengths. It's almost hard to fathom how far this Don Berg-led board would go to try to protect their decision involving Chamandy's ouster.
So this happened later on in the contest, but at some point, the Browning West change of control distant slate gained the support of both major proxy advisors, ISS and Glass Lewis. And that's very rare, both proxy advisors to support an entire distant slate of activist-backed candidates. I mean, I can think of only a few related situations where activists succeeded at installing a change of control slate of directors, Matt Calley, Ameren, and most importantly, and I think this is one that also received the support of both major proxy advisors, was Darden in 2014. And so in that case, for our listeners who may not be aware, although this is a situation that all activist advisors have carefully looked at and reviewed in the decades since it happened. But in that situation, activist investor Starboard Value succeeded installing a 12-person change of control slate at Darden, which owns Olive Garden, after both major proxy advisors urged to support the dissonance. So, Andy, you worked on that one. Can you talk a little about the similarities between Darden and Gildan?
Yeah, sure. Look, there are some striking similarities when you break down both of those control proxy fights. And to me, and similar thematics. And when I think about Darden 10 years ago, and I think about Gildan, which happened this year, what kicked things off was a board making a material decision without polling or showing any real interest in, you know, first understanding how such decision would resonate with its shareholders. And that decision was the one in Gildan that was announced on December 11th, which was the termination of Shamandy in favor of Vince Tyra. Mm-hmm. And at Darden, it was the decision of the board without seeking shareholder approval of the sale of Red Lobster.
And the price they sold Red Lobster and its real estate for. But anyways, go on.
Yeah. And what strikes me, and this is the similarity that I'm getting at, is in both, what you saw after the board made that sort of key decision that rankled shareholders is a board that then subsequently doubled down in a manner that showed a blatant disregard for the interests of shareholders. And if you remember back in Darden, Starboard launched into a special meeting campaign. Likewise here at Gildan as well, one of Browning West's first maneuvers was to avail itself of the ability to call a special meeting with 5% of the outstanding shares. At Darden, it was a bit different. It was a special meeting in the first instance was to get to a certain threshold to call the special meeting. That was what the solicitation was about, to basically compel the board and say, hey, board, slow down before you make this irreversible and incredibly important decision that Starboard and other of its holders have some severe concerns with. And in both instances, the boards prodded forward and batted away the deep concerns of its shareholders, such deep concerns that in each of the situations, the respective activists went so far as to call or seek to call a special meeting. So, you know, that's what strikes me. And then when I think about, and I had alluded to it earlier, this idea of the perfect storm of circumstances, you really need that. I don't think in either the Gildan fight or the Darden fight that going into it, launching on the initial state of the activist campaign, that either side, either activist thought this was necessarily going to be a control fight or a once a decade proxy fight type landmark success. It all depends on how a board and its advisors decide to react. And that's what helps fuel the perfect storm. And in both instances, that storm was fueled by the way that the board responded to the shareholder outcry.
That's quite interesting. I guess a red flag should be if the activist is seeking to call a special shareholder meeting and is not, you know, willing to wait for the next annual meeting. And my understanding is that special meetings, you have a higher threshold to get your directors elected than at an annual meeting. Then the company should know that the activist thinks that they have a pretty substantial amount of support.
Exactly. Yeah. And when I think of another similarity, and I wanted to take a minute to mention this as well, you think about the players involved. And Darden, it was Starboard a decade ago. And this year at Gildan, it was Browning West. We're talking about two of the most thoughtful investors that I've come across in my now nearly two decade career. The level of conviction they have, there's similarities that run in that regard as well. When I think about Usman Nabi and his partner, Peter Lee at Browning West and the team at Starboard as well, you know, you have deeply thoughtful, highly engaged, incredibly smart people who are unwavering and relelentless when they feel there's a cause that needs to have attention drawn to it and changes that are required to be made. And so that's another similarity I would point to as well.
Yeah, definitely. Both have pretty strong track records. Ronnie West hasn't done much activism, but when the founder did do activism, he was quite successful. So
just a quick sidebar, when you think about probably two of my top proxy contest victories have been ones where Usman has been involved and instrumental, whether it was at his former firm, H Partners, and the withhold campaign at Tempur Sealy.
Oh, yeah.
And then now Gildan this year. I mean, those are two seminal proxy fights that talked about for quite some time.
Yeah. So if he's going to launch a proxy fight, it must be a pretty bad situation where he's going to be pretty successful, I suspect. So Okay, let's go back to Gildan. I want to talk a little bit about Gildan's defensive refreshes, which we touched on a little bit at the beginning of our conversation and also factored into the historic win. So in April, Gildan announced that 7 directors were stepping down and it was adding 5 new directors. And these new 5 directors ultimately were removed also. So I'm trying to figure out, calculate how many directors were removed altogether.
It's remarkable, Ron. I mean, I've done the math in all from inception of this campaign through the AGM in late May, 17 Gildan directors in all were removed or forced to resign due to this campaign, due to Browning West's activism and proxy fight. I mean, when you think about it, that's almost 3 campaigns in one. They fought not just the incumbent board that made the decision announced on December 11th regarding the CEO succession. The problem, though, and you just alluded to the defensive refresh, the refresh that occurred in mid to late April, where 5 directors immediately stepped down with 2 others to step down thereafter, and then the additional 5 new board members. To me, that's not a real refresh. It was a ruse. It was a botched refresh. Why? Because those new board members came in guns a-blazing. They came in as anti the activist, anti Browning West, anti calling basically, I can't remember the exact words that Hodgson, the new chair, used, but basically using kind of derogative terms in describing the activist and standing so firmly behind Vince Tyra and the decision to hire him and fire Shamandy that it was kind of the same old, same old. Where's the refresh? What you would expect and what you would hope for in a refresh amidst a proxy fight like this is that you would get new board members and that the old board, the outgoing board members would seek new directors who have, putting aside the, you know, in industry expertise, but who would come in with fresh eyes and an open mindset and listen to the shareholders and try to understand what is the angst all about? Why are we in this, admired in this proxy fight to begin with? But instead, it was just an obvious continuation of the same mindsets that resulted in the control proxy fight to begin with.
It seemed to me like this was, you know, the decision that they removed just enough of the directors. You know, they removed the chairman who was considered major, you know, a lot of the investors had raised concern about the chairman. I feel like they felt that they had removed just enough that maybe they could keep Vince Tyra in as CEO. But that clearly wasn't the case. Ultimately, the new directors were removed too. And, you know, why wasn't the
master? There's no one they could have brought forward to and installed as a director here that would have changed the complexion or direction of this proxy fight. Directionally, it was all about reinstating Glenn Shamandy. And in terms of how Browning West and other investors alike viewed Shamandy as a transformational figure in this industry and a value creator, there's going to be no real middle ground. And that's why you don't really see situations like this settling. The funny thing is there were settlement talks. There were back and forth discussions, but there were also lines drawn. And we had the spots where we drew the lines in the sand and the company, likewise, the board had areas where it drew the line in the sand and they were unwilling to consider and reconsider the decision and to reinstall Shamandy in any way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. So where do you settle when the conviction of the activist and such a large portion of the shareholder base is that this company needs this leader and the company was drawing that line in the sand that there's no way, shape, or form can any deal involve the reinstatement of this leader? You're going to get a fight like this. And that's what we saw. Look, we haven't even touched upon some of the other tactics. This was, again, they tried to pull out every defense trick in the book. And that's why the cost soared. And then we see comparisons to Disney when Disney is such a large market cap. It was remarkable. Every day for 6 months, we were dealing with something new, whether it was a U.S. claim about HSR, whether it was litigation threatening letters to shareholders, alleging acting in concert when there was clearly no collusion or anything of the like. So we were dealing with a board that seemed so desperate and were so dug in their heels to such an extent that they basically set loose their advisors to come up with and to deploy every single defensive play in the book.
One of the interesting creative defensive strategies they did earlier on was they brought in what I guess I and others in the activism space call a white squire defensive strategy, where they added, essentially they added an activist investor, Coliseum Capital's co-founder, Chris Shackleton, to the board. Shackleton was installed in December as part of, in my view, a defensive strategy. Coliseum owned a 6% stake and was backing the company's future with Vince Tyra. This kind of defensive strategy, I feel like, could have worked in other situations, but it didn't work out here. And in fact, Andy, correct me if I'm wrong, Shackleton was one of the directors that resigned or was removed in kind of that late stage shakeup.
That's exactly right. He was a part of the mid to late April announced refresh, where he was going to be voluntarily stepping aside, not immediately, but as of the AGM, but he was out. And now look, that was a move calculated and designed to try to bridge the gap between the board and the highly concerned shareholders, including Browning West. And that they thought by bringing in Shackleton, I'm assuming, is that, look, we can have someone that's not viewed as attached to our decision regarding Shamandy's ouster and the hiring of Vince, because he's coming in after that, and who has a shareholder mindset that could see from the inside why we did what we did as a board, and then communicate with other holders and in kind of as an intermediary to try to, like, as I said, bridge the gap. But it didn't work, and it wasn't ever really going to work. It was a lot of hubris on the board's part to think, and perhaps Shackleton as well, to think that he was going to be able to play that kind of a kingmaker role here, where the line had been drawn in the sand that the board was unwilling to entertain the reinstatement of Shamandy, which was clearly what this large portion of the shareholder base wanted and wanted done immediately. So it was one of those, like, yes, they tried everything. Again, a kitchen sink strategy. They're like, why not? They tried so many other. They tried a sale process as a ruse or as a pretense to, you know, anything to avoid accountability, anything to avoid the vote come May 28th. They were going to try. Look, what's an interesting sort of element here? I mentioned the special meeting call earlier. We were told by company advisors that there was likely going to be a delay in the AGM, that they were looking to maybe delay into the late fall. Well, Browning West and other investors, that sent shockwaves and fear. Like, look, any day with this company under the watch of Vince Tyra is a day too long, that there could be irreversible value destruction. They didn't want to wait and even until May. And so we called the special meeting, but the special meeting played another role too, because the special meeting forced the board's hand. They could bat away the special meeting, but what it forced them to do is to actually stick to their AGM timeline of late May. So it was interesting. The special meeting is an interesting tool in Canada, and it really can force the company's hand and not allow a undue delay of the AGM itself. So I really like that strategy. And again, as I'm talking about it, this was a unique situation in that it was cross-border. It's a foreign private issuer, which means that it's a company that has to adhere to certain SEC regulations while it's based in Canada and under Canadian law. So I'd be remiss not to give a shout out. It wasn't just me leading the charge on the legal here, the legal strategy, but the team at Goodman's did a phenomenal job. They had to deal with John Feldman and his team of litigators. Yeah, like every step of the way in terms of the litigation. And there's a lot of decision making that goes into this, you know, in terms of the various lawsuits being brought, timing of lawsuits. It was all hands on deck for a good part of 5 or 6 months.
Okay, so we're running out of time, but I can't help but have to just take a couple of minutes to go over, and you've alluded to this a couple of times already, the breathtaking cost of this for Gildan. And on its second quarter earnings call, Gildan reported that the six-month proxy battle cost $76.8 million. So this involved a lot more than typical proxy contest costs, which are legal, proxy solicitation, and also included litigation. Maybe go over some of the different costs that you think went into this cost. Did it include like severance to outgoing directors?
I was going to mention that. That's a big chunk of it. I mean, at least I would say half, almost half. I don't have the numbers. I don't purport to know the numbers, but just thinking about it, when this board had to make some decisions in the latter stages of the campaign, and as they were all deciding to resign en masse, they were also taking steps to protect Vince in all this. Hey, we've got to he's ruined three, however many months of his life. The future here at Gildan is done. There's got to be a way to remunerate him. And so, look, I think they paid him a hefty severance change of control fee. I think there's other executives as well that were stepping aside that were promised and paid exorbitant change of control fees. So a big chunk of it is that. Look, a big chunk of it, I have to imagine, is the company's defense and advisory team.
Right. Because they had a lot of litigation expenses as well.
Well, there was everything. You name it as a tactic, this contest had it. And so when you just, the sheer involvement, the sheer number of the lawsuits, the number of, we haven't even begun to talk about, and I know we don't have time on this one, but maybe there's a part two at some time, but they're all the experts that they paid to try to validate their decision-making. They had a governance expert for every decision that the board made relating to the succession, relating to this, that, or the other. They had side agreements, pro forma agreements with investors in the Montreal area in Quebec with Case about a performance. There were bankers. When you have a company that's willing to go the way of scorched earth tactics, it's not surprising to me to see the costs mount in the way they did.
Yeah, I just still think that if you were to take out, you know, the severance expenses and just look at the, you know, the core proxy solicitation, legal, maybe banking, and fees, it still would be similar to the Disney contest, right?
It very well may be.
I just want to look, Disney has 156 billion market cap, while Gildan is about a 7 billion market cap. So
I agree. It's a huge head scratcher. And that's why I think maybe there's some reputations that from the directors and board members who propagated all this and dug in their heels and set loose their advisors to play every defense tactic in the book. It's not going to go over well, I don't think, for them. It'll be interesting to see if they're ever able to land director positions again for certain of these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, definitely. Very, very interesting. Okay, this has been a fascinating story. I think it'll be maybe in some textbook somewhere as kind of an interesting case study for activism. And I've been fascinated. You know, I think it's the most interesting, if not one of the top three most interesting proxy contests of the year. So, Andy, I'm so glad we had some time to chat about it. This has been Ron Orrell, host of the Activist Investing Today podcast. And I've been speaking to Andrew Friedman of Olshan. Thank you, Andrew, for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.